Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's harvest time at the Garden of Hope at the Waterman Farm on Ohio State campus, where cancer patients and cancer survivors harvest vegetables and fruits as part of a two-year summer program. We wanted to talk about the relationship between the fresh food and wellness and the whole idea of having the Garden of Hope for cancer patients. Joining us is registered dietitian at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, Dina Champion. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
And also coordinator for the Ohio State Garden of Hope, Amy Barr. Amy, welcome.
Thank you.
And director of James Care for Life, that's the program associated with OSU's Arthur G. James Cancer Hospital, Annie Trance. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Listeners, if you have a question or comment about the Garden of Hope, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513. So, Annie, why not just provide fresh food to patients and survivors? What's the significance of a garden?
Yeah, so when we look at how cancer is impacting people, we're looking at the whole person. We're looking at how your life is impacted by a cancer diagnosis from a physical perspective, spiritual, emotional, and of course, social and practical. So part of our programming, we look at how to engage people in plant-based diets. And we're using the garden as a means to do that. So really engaging them in the whole gardening process, giving them access to be out in nature right here in the middle of the city throughout the week. It's a really great program that builds community.
It's a two-year program, right?
It is. So participants are able to come to the program, do an orientation, and have access to garden 3 days a week throughout the summer.
What's the difference between something like the Garden of Hope and just doing it in your own backyard?
Wow. So our Garden of Hope is a 1.5 acre garden.
Okay.
So it's, I always look at it and I think, man, this isn't really gardening. It's kind of farming in a way. But the difference is we've got access to over 40 different types and varieties of vegetables and fruits. Participants can come out, talk to our dietitians, speak with Amy, our garden coordinator, about the growing process. And then right there, we have hands-on information on the specific nutritional benefits of each plant or each vegetable that they're harvesting that week.
We're talking about the Garden of Hope at Ohio State University. Well, it's not at what you think of as the usual Ohio State University. It's located at the Waterman Farm at Ohio State, and it's where cancer patients and cancer survivors garden 3 days a week. They can harvest the vegetables and fruits, and it's part of a two-year program. You just heard from Annie Trance. She's director of James Care for Life. That's a program associated with Ohio State's Arthur G. James Cancer Hospital. Also with us, Dina Champion, an OSU registered dietitian, and Amy Barr, the coordinator of Ohio State's Garden of Hope. And Amy Barr, how is the garden designed? What kind of thought went into how it was designed to do this?
Well, certainly a lot went into speaking with the dietitians ahead of time, finding out, you know, what vegetables would be very beneficial to our patients, but also just knowing that not everybody's going to show up to harvest kale. So, for example, right now,
kale gets such a bad rap.
It has a bad rap, but we're growing a couple different varieties of it out there. But we're also right now harvesting sweet corn, which maybe is bringing a lot of people who are excited about coming out to harvest fresh sweet corn. And then, you know, hopefully they'll benefit from everything else growing out there as well.
Is there a layout that was specific to this, or was it more a function of just how vegetables grow?
Yeah, I mean, we've basically redesigned the whole garden to make access as easily, you know, as possible. So I put up a big center aisle so everybody can go right up the middle and see the signs for whatever's everything that's available.
And it's accessible to, I mean, handicap accessible?
It is accessible as we could make it out on the farm. So certainly patients that need a little extra help, everything is made wide enough that they could walk next to a caregiver if they need to. There's also volunteers that can get down and help, you know, harvest, or if something's clear in the back, you know, they'll walk back there and pick for them.
Do people bring their family members?
Yes, a lot of them do. Many of them show up with a caregiver who is often a family member. They can also bring their children with them, and some of them do that. And they really want their kids to get out there and see where their food is grown and what's happening out there.
So how does it change perspective? Have you gotten feedback at this point from people about what kind of effect or impact this is having?
Yeah, I mean, we poll people at the beginning of harvest session and at the end. Sorry, not harvest session, the beginning of the season. Uh-huh. And then at the end of the season. And our goal is that participants are really looking at increasing the amount of vegetables and variety of vegetables that they're engaging in their diet. And we do get that feedback that people are listening and hearing about new vegetables and eating more in their daily diet. But also, I think another benefit of the garden is that it does build a community. And, you know, it's really a nice way for patients to kind of come out and engage with each other, with staff and with volunteers, you know, out in nature, outside of the hospital. So it sort of has an emotional benefit along with the nutritional benefits as well.
And that's important. Dina Champion, the nutritional benefits of fresh food, vegetables, things that we don't have that are unprocessed. Why is this important for somebody who... For anybody, but of course, people with cancer.
Right. It's one of the most important modifiable lifestyle choices we can make is to choose healthy plant-based diet, you know, produce, heavy on produce, and making sure that we are at a healthy weight. Very, very important for preventing cancers and preventing cancers from reoccurring. And so what's really cool about this garden, I'm going to kind of tack on to what you said about, you know, kale getting a bad rap, is that we have all of these wonderful vegetables out there that maybe people think they don't like or maybe don't know how to prepare. And we don't just give them a vegetable and say, figure it out. We actually teach cooking classes and we teach them how to make vegetables tasty so that they can go home with their recipes and that they can incorporate it into their life.
Do you have an example of someone who's come to you and said, oh my God, I can't believe this, that I like this?
We offer not only our harvest sessions three times a week, but we also offer a cooking session once a month during garden season where a dietitian like myself and one of our chefs actually prepare some of the produce in front of participants so that they can, you know, try it and take it home. And I've got lots of examples. We had somebody just the other day who, you know, had never had eggplant, just never knew what to do with eggplant besides frying it. And, you know,
it is kind of tricky.
It is. You know, people fry it and put lots of cheese on top, and that's about all people know how to do. What
Which
to do with eggplant?
The purpose, right?
Exactly. So, one of our chefs made a really nice, easy baba ganoush recipe, and I had multiple people who had never tasted that, and they were so excited to be able to do that at home. And right after the class, they were able to walk out to the garden, take their eggplant home with their recipe, and make it for their families.
How do you talk about food choice in a way with people that doesn't sound like a prescription?
Yeah, it's an art. one of the things we try to do is, you know, make sure people understand that there is no such thing as a perfect diet. You know, we're not promoting that everybody eat, you know, perfectly all day, every day, if even such a thing existed. What we are promoting is a plant-based diet, meaning that most of the time you're choosing, you know, plants, fruits, vegetables, whole grains. But it also allows room for you to incorporate some things like meats and animal products if you choose to. The other thing we do as dietitians is we make sure people realize that really what's important is your overall eating pattern. So what you're doing most of the time, which allows you to leave room for some of those fun things that you enjoy, you know, birthday cake at a party or a cookie when, you know, your mom makes your favorite cookies or whatever it is. So we really try to make it easy for people and a lifestyle that can be maintained.
Can anybody go to this?
Yeah. So our programs are open to adults, so 18 and older.
Okay.
And their caregivers and families. And our programs are open to anybody who has a cancer diagnosis.
It doesn't have to be a patient at OSU.
No, okay. It does not have to be a James patient. The qualifier is that you have cancer. So as long as you're, you know, you're an adult, you can attend any of our programs, and the garden being one of those.
And I wanted to ask Amy Barr, if you coordinator at the OSU Garden of Hope, if you change things up from season to season, are you thinking about next year already?
Absolutely. I've already been talking to a lot of patients about what do you wish we had in this garden?
And what do they tell you?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, there have been some patients that, you know, we have a diverse population that comes, and so we're looking at maybe adding some ethnic choices next year, expanding on our Asian vegetables. We have some people from the Mediterranean that are giving me some ideas of things that they would like to see. So I'm really excited to incorporate that. And of course, everything will have to be changed up every year just to keep things growing well and not attracting
right.
the same insects back and everything
yeah,
like that.
Right. So
there's
move it around.
The horticultural side of it. But no, it's a great challenge. And I feel like people have been excited, and they are, you know, since they're coming to the garden, they're connecting with me and the other volunteers, and I think are very open to sharing, you know, what they like and don't like.
Yeah. And what about you, Dina, as far as how you work between the two of you and what the garden serves up and what people should be eating and what they were interested in eating?
Yeah, so that's a great question. You know, Amy and I are always kind of touching base back and forth with what kinds of things to provide. And I think what's really important, Annie mentioned that, you know, we offer at least 40 different types of vegetables and produce out there right now. And that's what's really important, is that we're allowing people to try many different things. It's really, really important that, you know, we encourage patients, or, you know, the public in general, to try to choose lots of color, lots of variety, because all of those colors represent different nutrients, which are important. So it's really important to us that we continue to be able to offer a vast array of choices out there.
Some people don't necessarily have the kitchen set up to do much cooking. You've probably had to have conversations with people like that, right?
Yes. So what we try to do is make sure that we have some really easy recipes available right there at the harvest session. So we've got our little binder all ready to go, and we've got recipes for just about everything out there that are extremely simple, very, very easy to do at home for people who maybe don't like cooking or don't want to cook, don't have the time to cook. So we try to make this very easy for them, very accessible to people.
And finally, Annie Trance, it was a 2-year program.
Yeah.
What's the verdict? I mean, this was the first year?
No.
It's the second year, wasn't it?
Well, this program has been in existence since around 2012.
Okay.
So the program now is a 2-year program, in the sense that as a participant in the program, you can be in the program for 2 years.
Okay.
And the reason for that is the goal is that we're introducing patients to these this information, to this practicing of gardening and eating healthy and eating a plant-based diet, and that then you're utilizing those things in your own life, and that you're adapting to these lifestyle changes. So it is a 2-year program. And we also hope to attract new patients each year. And so we want to keep it accessible and sustainable for people who need the information and kind of keep it to the mission of that.
And before I let you go, what's changed over time then? That's a 6-year period of time now. What's changed? How have you changed the program, or what have you learned?
We have changed a lot in the amount of nutritional programs that we offer in correlation with the gardening program. Yeah. We have a lot of robust different programs, like Dina was mentioning, with hands-on cooking and demonstrations. The other thing is that we have our own garden coordinator, Amy.
Oh, Amy's new.
She's new this year, and she has brought a whole nother level of expertise to the growing process and looking at sustainable practices and how we can incorporate that into our garden as well. So these are, you know, having a robust team of people and volunteers has been really exciting.
Well, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks
That's
for having us.
Annie Trance, you bet. Annie Trance, director of the James Care for Life, a program associated with The Ohio State University's Arthur G. James Cancer Hospital. Also, Dina Champion, she's OSU Wexner Medical Center registered dietitian, and Amy Barr, coordinator of the Ohio State Garden of Hope. We'll have a link to their website so you can learn more about it. on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be back with more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A new analysis of when women in the United States have babies reveals that age is affected, that shows that the age at which women become mothers varies significantly by geography and education. Sociologist at Louisiana State University, Dr. Heather Racken, studies fertility trends and demography. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
The analysis found that the age at which women become mothers varies a lot by geography and education. What do we know about the differences between geography?
So basically, the findings show that women become mothers at older ages in large coastal cities, and they become mothers at younger ages in rural areas, the Great Plains and the South.
And why does that vary that way, do we know?
So I think one of the big axes of differentiation is really education, because there's a lot of other factors associated with living in these different types of places, and probably one of the biggest ones is education, and we know that there's this really huge gap in age at first birth by education. So moms with college degrees become mothers when they're older, and women with lower levels of education, so without a college degree, become mothers sooner.
I wonder, do we know which comes first, the chicken or the egg? And no pun intended, but if you get pregnant, you don't go on and do higher ed?
So that's something that researchers have looked into, and it looks like, I don't know if we're exactly sure where we stand on that, because it might be a little bit of both, right? Mm-hmm. So it might go in the way that you said, where let's say you get pregnant early, so it might make it more difficult to complete college, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it could also be that just certain types of women, right? So women who come from backgrounds where their parents were highly educated are also likely to go on to college and likely to wait to have births, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it could be that just the types of women who are more likely to do both higher education and have kids later there's something selecting them into that. So it's not really clear which one is coming first, if education is causing it, right? So
mm-hmm.
I don't know if we, you know, if we made it where everybody was forced to go to college, does that mean that mm-hmm. everybody would wait till after 30 to have kids? I don't think that's actually the case.
Mm-hmm. And the first-time parent ages, it's changed. It's kind of the demographics are more separated than ever before now, right?
So the age gap in age at first birth has narrowed slightly just in recent years, so compared
okay.
to the 90s and times like that. But that's really because there's been a pretty big decline in teen births.
Hmm.
But lots of those people who would have had teen births are just kind of pushing it off to the early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily a teen birth, but, you know, the question is there really that much difference between, you know, age 19 and age 20? But if it depends on when you're comparing it to, but if you're comparing the gap in age at first birth to, say, the 1960s, well, the gap is much, much, much larger now.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the demographics of women when they have their first babies in the United States. My guest is Heather Racken. She's a sociologist at Louisiana State University, and she studies fertility. Heather Racken, what about contraception? How does that play into it? Before the 60s, a lot of it was illegal.
Yeah, so contraception is definitely one factor that allows women to postpone births, right, and do so way more effectively. So contraception, and but it's not just contraception, right? There's also like broader social trends. So back in the 50s and 60s, there was really only one acceptable family form, right? And that was sort of a heterosexual married union with children. And the vast majority of couples married early and had children in their early to mid-20s.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, and part of this is contraception, but also part of this is social trends and economic trends are driving this. There's been sort of this increasing divergence in like how and when people form families. And sometimes we call this the convergence to divergence. So there's a lot of divergence going on, and probably one of the biggest factors driving that is education or socioeconomic status.
What about fertility rates? You study fertility. Has this been affected by that?
So do you mean sort of the age of first birth, is that connected to the fertility, declining fertility rate?
Yes.
So I am actually not sure. The declining fertility rates, that could be the result of what we call postponement, is just like women are just waiting, but they're going to have those kids eventually.
Mm-hmm.
So there's really, most people say that, you know, 2 point some children is ideal for their family. And so we don't know if they're just waiting, right? If somebody's 35, they still have a lot of years to have more children. I think that there are declining fertility rates, but I think we need to wait a little while and see if people are going to make up those births, right,
mm-hmm.
At later ages.
And the geography factor, geography can affect a lot of people. They don't have transportation. They have less access to opportunities and other things, right?
Yeah, so geography can, you know, matter for access to contraception, access to education, good jobs. But also geography can matter just kind of because of the community that you're in, right? Mm-hmm. So who you're around. So, you know, people are social animals, and they kind of get their cues about what the appropriate behavior is depending on who they see around them. So if you're in coastal cities in a, you know, say New York City, and you're a young mother, people might look at you kind of funny and you might feel kind of weird, right? Because there's just not that many people in that same boat as you, as opposed to if, let's say, you're in a rural town in Louisiana, where people might look at you weird if you're, you know, 38 with a brand new baby.
Hmm. And what about religion? How does that play a role?
So I'm not exactly sure how religion plays a role, but it does seem that women who become moms earlier tend to be more religious and have more traditional gender role attitudes compared to women who become moms later. And so I'm not exactly sure, sort of, is it these religious values that are saying, you know, oh, it's good to become a mother, that this role is really important, and so that's kind of leading women to want to do it earlier, or if it's just, you know, religion is associated also with education and with other lifestyle factors, which might, you know, select women into having earlier births.
Do we know if about the health advantages or disadvantages and how it might be affecting these different demographic groups when it comes to that first child?
I think that we could actually, like, kind of, if we want to think about health, we might want to also think about life expectancy, right? And so maybe why certain groups are having kids earlier and other groups are having kids later.
Mm-hmm.
And so we also see really big differences, really big inequality in life expectancy. So just to give you an idea, so those with a college degree have an adult life expectancy that's a decade longer than those without a high school degree. So you could kind of see that having children at age 40 might make a lot of sense if someone has a college degree, because they're seeing people live healthy lives until their 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
But it might not actually make as much sense for people who have lower levels of education to have kids later, because they might see people starting to get sick and die at 50, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so sort of health might, like, and perceptions of what your future health might actually be something that's sort of pushing people to have children earlier or later.
And it seems counterintuitive that unmarried lower-income women have children earlier than their married high-income counterparts, or particularly the income thing. What about that? What do we know about why people pursue parenthood when they're broke?
Okay, so I kind of think of it as this might be like a symptom of inequality, right? Is so we can kind of think of our economic mobility as like a ladder, right? And so more recently, as economic inequality has gotten bigger, the steps on the ladder, so the steps to move up are getting further and further and further apart, right? So people on the bottom might be having children earlier because they really don't see any economic benefit in waiting, right? They don't. It's hard to get up to that next stage in the ladder. So it's not like they can see if they just waited a few more years, they would have higher income. That just doesn't seem like a possibility, right? So they might be finding meaning in parenthood, especially when meaning from other sources, like, you know, high-paying careers or education, is really hard to come by, and it doesn't seem like that will happen in the future, kind of, you know, no matter what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also some things associated with being at the bottom of the economic ladder without much hope of moving up that encourage earlier parenthood, like the dying earlier, like having more unintended births, right? So mm-hmm. that's something that, you know, there's just more unintended births of people who are at that bottom part of the distribution. And also maybe trying to find the center of stability, right? So children can be the source of stability in an unstable and precarious world.
Yeah, I was gonna ask you about the unintended birth piece of this. What do we know about why that is, with the, you know, at one end more so than the other?
So it used to not be sort of as big of a divergence mm-hmm. in unintended births, but now it's definitely larger, and I think it's associated with all of these other trends that we see in social and economic life. So we see a lot of divergence, in increasing divergence in so many things related to family, and either in other areas that I'm not as familiar with, like political polarization and things like that.
Hmm.
So we see it in unintended births, this big divergence. We also see it in the types of families that people are forming. So are they cohabitations? Are they marriages? We see it in family instability. So there's just this increasing divergence in all these factors. And I would say that that is likely related to these broader social factors, like increasing inequality, like changes in our economic structure, social factors, and then technological factors, because birth control has gotten better
mm-hmm.
And more effective. So if you have access to these effective forms of birth control and reason to use them, right, because mm-hmm. you have this hopeful future to look to,
mm.
Then you're probably more likely to be able to effectively wait to have birth.
And what do we know about the incidence of marriage at the two different ends?
So that's also diverging a great deal. So when we look at, say, marriage at the time of the birth, that for those with lower levels of education, so less than a college degree, marriage is declining at first births, and cohabitation is drastically increasing. So the proportion of people single, so not in any sort of union living with a partner, mm-hmm. has really stayed about the same. But what really has changed is it sort of switched from marriage to cohabitation for those with less education. Those with higher levels of education, they've had some increase in cohabitation, but really most of their kids are being born into marriages. And so that's making these really big differences in the types of unions that kids are being born into, depending on their mom's level of education.
Why aren't people getting married at the same rates at the different ends of the spectrum?
Well, I think it goes back to sort of this inequality.
The economics.
But there's also another. Yeah, and there's also another part that's really important is sort of the changes in male wages at different parts of the economic spectrum, right? So male wages have stagnated and in some cases even declined for those with lower levels of education. And so it makes marriage less attractive of an option, especially for women when, you know, it might be sort of more difficult to have, you know, another mouth to feed in the household. So, I mean, it's lots of these same sorts of big changes are driving these changes in marriage. But then there's also some other factors, like there's less stigma to have a non-marital birth now.
Right.
As opposed to, you know, even 20 years ago.
And so less stigma to be cohabitating versus married.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. So the stigma really has changed. So it's sort of this combination of, like, you know, social and economic factors.
Heather Racken, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Heather Racken is a sociologist at Louisiana State University. She studies fertility, and we've been talking about an increased incidence or a new analysis of when women in the United States have babies. It reveals that age as the women become mothers varies significantly by geography and education. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Doctors recommend we drink about 2 to 4 liters a day of water to stay properly hydrated. But too much of a good thing, well, it's too much. Overhydration is dangerous and it can be deadly if it's not treated right away. That's according to Associate Professor of Exercise and Sports Studies at Wayne State University in Detroit, Dr. Tamara Hugh Butler. She recently wrote about the issue for The Conversation. We'll have a link to our website to that article at WOSU.org/all sides. Dr. Hugh Butler joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You bet.
Being interested in this topic.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's that time of year. You know, I drive home every night and I see the football, you know, high school football's players out practicing for this upcoming fall season. And, you know, it's 89 degrees outside. When I was reading and preparing for this, I guess, a little shocked to find out that there is sort of this hydration shaming thing. I thought it used to be the other way where, come on, buck up, you don't need a drink. And now it's like if, you know, they have competitions for drinking. And that's where the overhydration is coming in.
Absolutely. You know, it used to be that you weren't tough if you needed to have a drink. And now hydration is being pushed so hard, particularly in football, where they actually hang these, like, urine color charts in the locker rooms. And they're like, if you have, like, brown urine, you're a bad teammate and you're very selfish. And so it's actually become a problem where they're going the other way. And it's fatal if you drink too much. And people actually don't realize that.
I knew about it with elderly parents. You know, they drink too much and they don't have enough sodium in their system. Not quite sure exactly what happens, but I knew it was bad. But let's talk about, first of all, what we're supposed to drink every day. What are we shooting for?
Well, you know, that's an interesting concept because everybody wants a fixed amount and everybody wants to know how much do I need to drink. But that varies significantly versus, you know, so the things that have to be taken into account are how big you are. Mm-hmm. I'm 90 pounds and my colleague is 250. So obviously if you say, oh, you know, we all need 8 glasses of water, that's just not going to hit the gamut of people's size.
Yeah.
And then also, how hot it is obviously is going to make a big difference. If it's it's like 89 like it is this week, then you're going to need more because you're going to be sweating. But if it's, you know, when the winter comes and it's minus 20, you know, we're not going to be sweating that much, so we don't need as much. And then what happens too with athletics is the harder that you exercise, the more intense that you exercise, the more that you sweat, so you will need more. So to have like one recommendation that fits everybody doesn't work. And that's the one thing that we've really tried to get away from is like everybody doesn't need 8 glasses because some do and some, it might be too much for some people and it might be not be enough for others. So
we're talking about the problem of overhydration. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Tamara Hugh Butler. She's an associate professor of exercise and sports studies at Wayne State University. If you have a question or comment about hydration, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Dr. Hugh Butler, what happens when you overhydrate? What's happening to the body?
So again, too, another misconception is it's all about the water. But as you mentioned before, it's about the balance between water and salt. So if you drink too much or you lose too much sodium and the water starts to dilute the salt, the bad thing is that makes all of the cells in your body swell. And this is really bad in two places. One is your brain and the other is in your lungs. So if your brain cells swell too much because you drank too much water and or lost too much salt, your brain actually will swell and runs out of space in the skull, and it pushes your brain stem out, and that's how people die. Yeah. And then, too, if you drink too much.
I'm holding my job, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, and most of the time it's preventable. And then what happens, too, is your lungs can fill up with fluid, and so people have pulmonary edema. But those are the two really, really bad things that happen. But every single cell in your body swells if you drink so much that you dilute the sodium. So, again, too, there's a water component, but there is also, as you said, a sodium component as well.
I learned that at a pretty young age when I was backpacking in the Upper Peninsula in Isle Royale. And Michigan, and I met a guy on the ferry who was coming back, and he had to cut his trip short because he lost too much salt.
Yes, that can happen. And again, too, it goes back to, you know, everybody's salt in their sweat differs as well. So it's a combination that people don't realize. But again, too, you know, the thing is like, oh my God, so how much water, how much salt is? But we have these sensors in our brain that actually, in real time, as we're sitting here, are like sampling our brain for water and salt all the time so that it fixes it for us.
And they tells us, hey, are you thirsty? You probably need to drink something.
Absolutely. But the thing is, they're saying thirst is too late, but it's not. It's just thirst is like when you're starting to get like, okay, we're retaining water, so we're not peeing it out, but we need a little bit more, and that's when you get thirsty. And all animals, land mammals, worms, bugs, they all have this mechanism because it's crucial to survival. So to say it doesn't work is like, it goes against 700 million years of evolution.
But humans are different than earthworms because we also have other things going on in our life. We're distracted by other stuff.
Right. And we have these really big frontal lobes that make us think. And so the thing is that we think that we can outsmart our body.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we can, but a lot of times when athletes and people get in troubles when they think they're doing the right thing and the body actually can't compensate for it.
Let's hear from Fred in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Fred.
Hi. Well, I think you actually just took my question, which is, why don't you just drink when you're thirsty? Why is that not the rule?
That is the rule.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you know, I think that sometimes, particularly kids, when they're on an athletic team, maybe they don't want, they're thirsty. They're out there, they're thirsty, but they can't take a break right at that moment.
Correct. And so our recommendation is like have a variety of fluids available and allow them to drink when they're thirsty. And that's the recommendation that hits everybody in all situations.
Hmm. Fred, thanks a lot. Sarah in Marysville, you're on the air. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I have to be out in the weather a lot for the work that I do, and I've had to be out on those heat advisory days, working from 8 in the morning to 8 in the evening. Mm. I'm also a high-functioning person with autism, so I get hyper-focused on what I'm working on, and I've had a friend told me to set my alarm clock on my phone, you know, so that I at least go back to the house and suck down some liquids. But I've also been having some digestive issues, and I've lost a lot of weight this summer because I can't figure out what I can eat and not have problems. So I'm trying to figure out what would solve both problems of getting some calories, some high-quality calories in, and getting enough liquid.
Hmm. You know what's good for that? Smoothies.
Smoothies, yeah.
I mean, that is liquid, and it's like what you can tolerate. Can you tolerate the bananas? Can you tolerate a little bit of protein? But those, you know, that you can get protein as well as carbohydrates and a host of other nutrients in a liquid form. And in most cases, people who have digestive issues, and this goes into like people who raise for days, most people can tolerate liquid. So this playing around with different types of smoothie drinks, which are probably be your best bet. You get everything that you would need. But it's, again, finding what works for you and what you can tolerate.
Right. Sarah, thanks for that call. You know, Sarah brings up an interesting thing. I was going to ask you about, what about sports drinks? What do they add or subtract from the equation when it comes to hydration or dehydration?
So most sports drinks have a little bit of sugar, which is a good thing because when you exercise, you know, there's a limit to how much glycogen that you can store in your muscles and liver. So if you're exercising for long periods of time or very intensely, you'll need to replace your glycogen. What a lot of them also have is sodium. But everyone thinks, oh, you know, you can replace your sodium. But this is, it's in very, very small amounts. And so our body, the sodium concentration in our blood is like 140 millimoles per liter. The sodium concentration in a sports drink is 18 millimoles per liter. So it's not a lot of salt, but it's a little bit. Sometimes it increases your palatability, and the little bit of sodium may help increase your circulation, but it's not a whole lot. So a sports drink generally has a little bit of sugar, a little bit of sodium, maybe a little bit of potassium. But again, too, it goes back to what can you tolerate. It's you have to self experiment. But that's a classic component. So again, too, there's a homemade version of Gatorade, and it's like lemonade and a pinch of salt and a little bit of sugar, and that's what it is.
Does it matter what you drink when it comes to hydrating? Could I be short of alcohol? That's a different issue. But
yes.
Say I'm drinking, Say I'm drinking coffee, or I'm drinking a Coke, or I'm drinking lemonade, or I'm drinking water. What does it matter? Are you hydrating one way or the other?
Absolutely. It doesn't matter. You know, it's not like you have to have exclusively 8 glasses of water. Anything counts. And even there's a lot of water in the food, particularly in the fruits and the vegetables, you know, the watermelon. So, yes, and there's also a mistake that people think that caffeine and coffee is a diuretic, but it's not. They've shown if you take the same amount of coffee and the same amount of water, you pee about the same amount. So anything other than probably the alcohol is fine, but alcohol does count as liquid, but it has its own special problem.
Right. I mean, alcohol counts as liquids, but you don't hydrate the same way with alcohol, right?
Well, after a time, like, so again, people at a bar, you know, it's like breaking a seal. If you drink too many beers, you know, once you start, you'll start to pee a lot more because it will, there's a mechanism where it makes you pee a little bit more. So people say it is dehydrating, and it actually could be. The alcohol does something to your kidney so that you actually lose a little bit more water the more that you drink, which is probably a safe thing.
So let's talk about symptoms of overhydration. They're hard to see, and I when I read your article, you know, you made the salient point, no pun intended, that if, you know, sometimes if people are taken to the hospital and the emergency crew doesn't understand that they're overhydrated, it often presents as dehydration.
Yeah, this, you know, that's the scary thing for us in the sidelines and for all the trainers is it looks exactly, you know, it looks the same. You know, if you have a really bad headache, you have muscle cramps, you have nausea and vomiting, those are all symptoms of both dehydration and overhydration. But again, too, you know, people hear, dehydration, and they immediately like pop an IV in, or they say, or the parents on the sideline goes, drink more. But they may be overhydrated, and that actually makes it worse, and that's actually how people die. So, you know, it looks the same. You need a blood test.
So you need a blood test, but how soon, once you're overhydrated and you're starting to go into distress, how much time do you really have?
You know, so what happens a lot of times is people are exercising and they drink a lot, and once they stop, the absorption rate from your gut into your blood actually accelerates. And so once you start to have once you start to absorb more fluid, I mean, it's a matter of minutes. And so it can be very, very dire. It's very explosive. People say, well, you know, people dying of overhydration is rare, but it's so preventable and it happens so fast. You start to have convulsions and then it's a really bad deal. You can go south really quickly.
I think it was in your article that you referenced the kids, you know, the young athletes who are guzzling a gallon of water before they go out and exercise. That's not good either.
No, you know, even the kids here, I mean, everyone's walking around with their gallon jugs of water because they're told to drink it. Mm-hmm. But again, too, it's making them pee. But what happens when you exercise? Exercise actually puts you in water conservation mode. Mm-hmm. So if we sat here and tried to drink a gallon, we're just going to be running to the bathroom and peeing. But when you start to exercise, your body says, hey, I need this stuff. And so you can't get rid of it as easily. And that's why exercise actually can make overhydration worse.
A quick call from Mike in Youngstown. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to know about coconut water and the coconut pieces in coconut water. Are they favorable for hydration, or are they better, or are they neutral, or are they worse, or where does coconut water fall?
Coconut water is just a form of liquid, and if you can tolerate it and it tastes good for you, that's great. But, you know, is it any better or worse as a hydrator, or is the pieces any better or worse? It's equivocal. It goes more to, like, do you like it and can you tolerate it?
Are you seeing this? We've only got a few seconds left, but I'm wondering, are you seeing more education on this now that they're teaching them more, or do we still have coaches out there doing these urine charts?
We're still seeing more of these urine charts. And so, again, too, I wrote the article.
So we should ask our kids, is someone doing a urine chart in the locker room?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and again, too, and point in my direction.
Yeah, right. Well, we'll post a link to your article on our website at WOSU.org. In the meantime, Dr. Tamara Hugh Butler, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, and have a wonderful day.
Thanks, you too. Tamara Hugh Butler is the Associate Professor of Exercise and Sports Studies at Wayne State University in Detroit. Thanks for listening today. This has been Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.